have our first case on oral argument this morning, 99-1702, Christopher Waters versus Kenneth Hertzborn et al. And we have arguing for Christopher Waters et al. And Matthew Seeger.
Good.
And then we have a slight change today. We'll have Kay Hunt arguing for Kenneth Hertzborn et al. And Mr. you will represent Nicholas House, too? Okay. Thank you, counsel. You may begin.
Good morning, I'm Matthew Beeger of the law firm of Dordrill and Scal. Martha Height is present with me at council table. I represent plaintiffs Christopher Waters and his parents. Chris was severely injured when the sled he was riding went into a public street and was struck by a motorist. On defendant's motion, the trial court ordered that liability issues be bifurcated and tried separately from damages. Plaintiff challenges that order for bifurcation. When I use bifurcation today, I'm talking about the device whereby the trial court severed the liability case from the damages case and ordered them tried before separate juries. That's what I'm meaning when I say bifurcation. Now, this is a wonderfully complex case, and it's a good opportunity to brush up on the law regarding accounts rendered and all those 18th and 19th century procedures. But I am mindful of the court's policy to decide cases on the narrowest possible grounds and not reach a constitutional issue if it can decide it on other grounds. Let me tell you what I think the simplest way is to resolve this issue. Back in 1974, a rule was proposed by the Judicial Council and enacted. That rule is now Section 80505, separate trials. That rule used as a model and to a large extent tracked Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 42B. However, the Judicial Council and this court specifically stripped that portion of 42B, which allowed trials on separate issues prior to adopting Section 80505. All of the commentators who write on Wisconsin practice, such as Harvey, have noted this important difference between the federal rules of procedure and the Wisconsin rules of procedure. Now, 15 to 20 years after 80505 was adopted, the Court of Appeals came along and issued the Zawistowski ruling that circuit courts had an inherent power to bifurcate issues under Section 90611. The Court of Appeals only addressed what had occurred with the adoption of 80505 in footnote 1, whereby it said simply that merely because the court did not authorize trials of separate issues in Section 80505, that doesn't mean it was preventing courts from doing so. I believe Zawistowski was wrongly decided. I believe that by deciding it in the fashion it did, the Court of Appeals usurped this court's rulemaking authority, and that there isn't any statutory authority or inherent authority for trial courts to bifurcate trials on separate issues.
Wasn't it one jury with a separated trial? I know your brief said you didn't think it was, but I think we read in another brief that it was.
My belief is that the record, at least as appears in the language of the Zawistowski case, isn't clear on that. I believe that there have been submissions to the court indicating that that is, in fact, what happened. Now, if you look at Section 90611, and it's interesting to note that while Section 80505 is entitled Separate Trials and found in the Civil Procedure section, Section 90611 is on the mode and order of presentation of witnesses and is found in the Evidentiary section. And clearly, in my mind, Section 90611 doesn't supply support for the procedural mechanism of bifurcating issues before separate juries. It is an evidentiary section allowing the judge to control the mode of putting on evidence and putting on witnesses in a trial. It doesn't have anything to do with severing portions of a case for separate trials.
Mr. Beeger, I think that is a strong point you make, but I think the defense raises a strong point also, which is that on remand, we frequently remand only on one issue, and that contradicts better evidence that, in fact, we do allow separate trials on separate issues in this state. How do you answer?
The way that I answer that is, if you look at remand or the Powers rule or similar procedural mechanisms, I don't believe they run afoul of either these statutory provisions or the constitutional issues. The reason is because I think a jury is entrusted to decide all of the factual issues in the case at the time the case is being heard by a jury. A jury is not obligated to decide an issue that has already been decided on summary judgment. A jury is not obligated to decide an issue that has been stipulated to by the parties. A jury is not obligated to decide an issue that has been decided on by the court as a matter of law on the basis of what has gone on in past court proceedings. Once the jury relinquishes its verdict to the court, there is any number of things that a court may do with that verdict. Some of them may involve remands for partial issues, but when the jury is receiving its case, it is only deciding all of the factual issues that remain in the case. Because the court made a ruling as a matter of law based on a previous jury determination, that's a separate matter and it doesn't run afoul of the rules. The jury only has to decide the factual issues that are present at the time it decides it. It doesn't have to decide things which have already been decided for some reason or another. Now, I think the case can be decided as I've just laid out, simply that there is not authority in the statutes. I would certainly like this court to also hold that bifurcation is unconstitutional and violative of the 5-6 rule. I would certainly like this court to state that bifurcation has some negative public policy implications, and I'll talk about both points, but I don't think the court needs to find either of those. I believe that the procedure that the circuit court is planning to follow is unconstitutional. This is extensively briefed by both sides. I won't restate all of the arguments. The primary constitutional issue is the question of uniformity or now adherence to the 5-6 rule. Objections to the specific mechanism of bifurcation are secondary. Now, we know a jury constitutionally consists of certain things. We know a jury has 12 people. We know that because of the case law, such as Norville and Hansberg. We know a jury constitutionally must be unanimous, or since the adoption of the new amendment to the Constitution, new being a relative term, 5/6. And we know that that's a constitutional requirement because there needed to be an amendment in order to reduce the standard from uniformity to 5/6. Question is, how can the unanimity requirement, or now the 5-6 requirement, be squared with bifurcation of separate issues before separate juries?
Yeah, my rhetorical question is, why can't it? I don't see in the Constitution where you can't have these people having separate trials or separate trials on these issues. So. Go ahead.
Let me tell you why I think that you can't. First of all, I think that the statutes you have tracking the case law, such as 805.09 and to some extent 805.12, talking about what a special verdict consists of, make it clear that all of the issues in the case need to be decided by the same 10 jurors, or at least all of the issues necessary to support a judgment in favor of the plaintiff. I think you also have case law interpreting that requirement, such as Christensen, which make it clear that the same 10 jurors must agree on all the elements necessary to support a verdict. So the argument, go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to think, so when you remand something back and then it's retried over and you have a different jury trying the issues, that's okay.
That is okay because when the jury is receiving it on remand, certain issues in the case have already been decided as a matter of law based on what a prior jury had done.
Yeah, so I guess I'm saying, well, isn't that what's happened in this case? Isn't that certain issues have been decided and the same 12 people get to hear the same issues with the same arguments?
As we stand here today, none of the issues in that case have been decided. There has not been a finding on recreational immunity. There has not been a finding on liability. There has not been a finding on damages. So all of those factual issues are currently present in this case as it's postured to go before a jury. The court has not decided any of those issues as a matter of law on summary judgment. The parties have not stipulated to any of those issues.
Can I go back to your statutory argument for a minute? It seems to be premised on the assumption that there must be a statute that allows this, otherwise the court can't do it. Is that what you're arguing?
That is essentially what I'm arguing. I'm arguing somewhat from the negative, in that not only do you have silence on that issue, the absence of express statutory authority, you had the Judicial Council in this court take a look at Federal Rule 42B, which specifically grants this authority, and determine that in the Wisconsin statute, it would not affirmatively give the grant to the circuit courts to bifurcate issues. And so you have more than an absence. You have this body and its rulemaking authority say, we're not going to have circuit courts do that. Moreover, I think if you're looking at any sort of inherent authority, you need to look at the historical record and the historical background. And again, I think that's very well briefed, but after looking at that, it is clear to me that this was not a feature historically of what courts or judges did at common law. And therefore, since you don't have the statutory authority, since you have this court specifically stating we're not going to give the circuit courts the statutory authority, and since I don't believe there's any historical basis for any inherent authority, I do believe there needs to be some exercise of the court's rulemaking authority before courts can go ahead and bifurcate separate issues.
Why isn't this part of a court's inherent authority to control the proceedings in court? Just because it wasn't historically done doesn't mean it's not part of the inherent authority.
Well, I think when you talk about what is within the court's inherent powers, I think that, again, it is to some extent constrained. It is not unlimited power, and it is constrained by the statutes that have been enacted or the rules that have been enacted concerning procedure. And a court does not have inherent authority.
But I understand it, but constrained is an important word here. Nothing in the rules prohibits this. It seems to me your argument is premised on the assumption that there must be something in the rules that permits it in order for a court to be allowed to do it.
And we talked in the brief about interpretation of rules, and the same rules as in statutory construction apply. And one of the things to look at when you're interpreting a rule such as 80505 on separate trials and saying, does this rule in any sense bar or prevent a court from going ahead and ordering separate trials on issues, is to look at the time of enactment, what this body did. And what the court did at that time is to specifically take out the language.
Did the court permanently take it out, or do we know exactly the circumstances under which that came to us? I mean, there's a couple of ways that this could have happened, a number of ways. You know, it could have had the language, and then by amendment the court took it out, or it could have come to us without it in.
My understanding is that the language was taken out by the Judicial Council when it made its recommendation to the court. I can't tell you, based on what I have seen, what the reason for that is.
Was it part of a draft? Was this language from the federal rules part of a draft and then subsequently no longer appeared in the draft?
That is my understanding. Whether it is part of a draft, I don't want to misuse the terms. My understanding is that they started with the federal rules as a model, and that starting with the federal rules as a model made the affirmative election to take out the language authorizing trials on separate issues.
Counsel, I see three spheres. This follows up, I think, Justice Sykes' question. A sphere of constitutional power and arguments regarding that. A sphere of the 805, 803 rules. And arguments regarding that. Then, let me advance, there's another sphere, the sphere of the superintending powers of the court for judicial sound and just judicial administration. Number one, can the court approach this case under the third sphere, as long as it's not prohibited by the Constitution or statute? In other words, can we address this case, assuming no prohibition, through the sphere of our superintending powers for sound judicial administration?
It can, but...
And if so, can we do that without a rulemaking process?
It can, but I think it only can do it by overruling many other cases which say it would be inappropriate to change the rule, such as it were, by virtue of hearing one case as opposed to going through the rulemaking process. There are a number of cases which we've cited that this court has said that that is an inappropriate way for the court to exercise its power in enacting these types of rules in superintending the Wisconsin judiciary. So assuming that there isn't a constitutional bar, the proper procedure would be for this court to entertain in its capacity as a rulemaker whether or not bifurcation of separate issues, which it deemed inappropriate or did not grant back in the early or mid-70s, is now something that it wants to grant the circuit court, and go through that procedure and enact a rule allowing circuit courts to do it, and maybe providing some guidance as to when and under what circumstances it should do it. However, again, there's a big if, and that if is if it doesn't run afoul of constitutional provisions, and we believe that it would run afoul of constitutional provisions.
It wouldn't run afoul of any existing 803, 805 rules as you see them right now. I mean, your position is there's kind of a silence. Isn't that your position with regard to those rules?
My position with regard to those rules is stronger than that there is a silence. That rule, for example, 80509, specifically requires agreement by 5/6 of the jurors on all elements necessary to support a plaintiff's claim. That 80512, discussing a special verdict, says that all issues must be in a special verdict singular or else they are deemed waived. With respect to the 80505 issue, there is a silence, but their silence must be informed by looking at what this court did back in the early mid-70s when it was considering adoption of the rule and considering adoption based on the model federal rules.
Is your 80509 rule argument the strongest of those of your rule arguments? Which one's the strongest?
I would think it's like picking between your children,
okay,
but
okay. I just thought I might answer it.
It
can't be that bad.
Maybe not quite that bad. I think that the language in 80509 is the clearest language prohibiting bifurcation of issues before separate juries. However, I think that 80505, while the language isn't as clear, the history is very clear, and I think that is the, whether or not it's the best argument, is the easiest way for this court to resolve the matter. I want to talk about one other argument that was raised by defendants, and that is the issue of coverage determinations and whether somehow a ruling in our favor in this case would throw 80304 and the various case law that has followed from that statute into some disarray. And I don't believe that that is something this court needs to be concerned about, because I don't think a ruling by this court outlawing or saying that the court doesn't have authority to grant separate trials on separate issues would impact it. The reason is that there is authority under the Constitution, under the rules, to allow separate coverage determinations. And the reason is that the direct action statute is not a creature of common law. That is a statutory cause of action. That being the case, the legislature, the court, whoever, has the right to condition a jury trial grant for that, because it's not an action of common law. So if in a typical case, plaintiff sues the defendant and the insurance company, the action against the insurance company, which you need to prove coverage, liability, and damages, it's perfectly okay to condition that right of direct action by saying, you, if the court orders you, need to try the issue of coverage first. And in that kind of case, my action against the insured would not have coverage as an element of damage, and therefore would not need to be tried together with the other claims against the insured. Therefore, nothing in a ruling in our favor is going to prevent coverage trials from being bifurcated and tried separately from liability and damage trials.
But the language of that statute I find very interesting, and this goes back to the inherent authority argument. It says sub 2B of 80304 says, nothing herein shall be construed as prohibiting the trial court from directing and conducting separate trials on the issues of liability to the plaintiff or other party seeking affirmative relief, and on the issue of whether the insurance policy in question affords coverage. The way that that's phrased seems to imply that the inherent authority is there and the legislature is just reminding everybody that it's there, and nothing that we've done here should be construed as impinging upon that inherent authority.
I read it differently. I read it that that statute doesn't mandate or offer an affirmative grant of the power to hold separate trials. It simply says that nothing in it prohibits a court from holding separate trials if otherwise appropriate. It doesn't say anything about the appropriateness of holding separate trials. It just says nothing in this statute is going to prohibit the court from doing so.
Well, and that seems to presuppose the inherent authority to do so, and that there is no requirement that any statute or rule, whether enacted by the legislature or this court, is required, that there doesn't have to be an affirmative grant of the power to do this, that it's part of the court's inherent authority, unless it's otherwise prohibited.
And I just do not read the statute that way. Certainly, courts in very certain circumscribed instances may bifurcate different factors. All that statute is saying, as I read it, is that nothing in it would prohibit a court from doing so. It's not an affirmative grant. I'm going to jump just very quickly to recreational immunity because the warning light is on. Here is how I read Section 2 of the recreational immunity statute. Section 2A deals with the duties a landowner has. And it says, if you allow landowners on your property, you're not going to have a duty to warn. You're not going to have a duty to make your property safe. And Section 2A, it seems to me, is not necessarily tied to where the injury occurred. Subsection B, which is the reason why we're here today, is different, and it focuses on the locus of the injury. And it says, in A, we've talked about duties, but here in B, we're going to talk about, notwithstanding that, under subsection B, if somebody is recreating on your land and they're injured, there isn't going to be liability, subject to the exceptions in Section 6. We're only here today talking about subsection 2B. I think subsection 2B, by its language, only applies to injuries or deaths which occur on the land. I think that is even more clear when you read the statute as a whole and read the exceptions, which in many cases specifically state that the exceptions only apply if the injury or death occurs on the land. Yeah, I think you get, and you've seen the hypotheticals.
The problem that I have with the argument that you're making now is that we've written recreational immunity cases on this court ad nauseum. And almost every case, we always cite the basic legislative intent of encouraging landowners to open up their property for recreational purposes. I have, let's say, a 40-acre piece of property that I want to allow people to snowmobile on or to walk in the woods, etc. But if I am told by this court or by the legislature that if somebody should happen to trip and fall 2 feet over onto somebody else's property and gets injured when they fall down, breaks their arm, the breaking of the arm occurred on my neighbor's property but 2 feet from mine, I'm not going to open up my property for recreational purposes. How do you answer that?
Let's talk about the parade of horrible hypotheticals with both sides engage in. Hypothetical posited by State Farm, tooling along on the snowmobile, hit a rock on the property, fly off, break your arm on the other side.
Which is not, I'm not sure that that's all that...
But let's talk about that. If, in my mind, first of all, realize we're not talking about negligence. We're not saying that there may be no negligence in that case. There may not be. We're talking about, even in cases of egregious negligence, is there going to be immunity? So who knows in that circumstance where there'd be negligence or not? But assuming some sort of negligence, look under sub A. And sub A says you don't have a duty to warn about that rock. You don't have a duty to remove that rock and make your property safe. Under sub A, you don't have those duties. Now, maybe you had a duty to, you know, six-year-old little Karen who was riding a snowmobile for the first time and you knew she really didn't know what she was doing. Maybe you had a different duty. And under those circumstances, liability would attach because sub B doesn't allow you to escape from liability merely because, you know...
Yeah, but as a landowner, I'm thinking, okay, that's all well and good, but if I have recreational immunity, that ends it before I have to expend thousands of dollars on attorney fees. But if I have to go through all of this to prove that I wasn't negligent, that's just not worth it.
Usually, I suspect whether it is going to be recreational immunity or a finding of no negligence, we can't stop people from suing people. It'll involve filing a summary judgment motion, having a ruling on it, and ultimately I think you have to look at the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario under what they are positing is that negligent people will be found to be liable. And I think the worst case scenario, if you do not allow liability to attach, if you immunize people from not just close cases, but from really egregious acts of negligence, that's a much worse case scenario. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hunt?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent Kenneth and Diane Hertzborn and State Farm Fire and Casualty Company, and I will be arguing the bifurcation issue on behalf of all respondents and then arguing the recreational immunity on behalf of the Hertzborns and State Farm. Now, the basic issue on appeal, as it's been certified to this court, is whether the trial court can constitutionally bifurcate the liability and damage portions of a jury trial and try these issues before separate juries. It is respondents' position that the circuit court's decision to bifurcate did not in any respect violate the Wisconsin Constitution. Now, the essence of a right to a trial by jury at common law requires that the facts be tried to the jury. As this court stated over 100 years ago, all that the right of a trial by jury entails is a fair and impartial jury, not the particular mode of designating it. If we go back to the historical record of the reasons for the Seventh Amendment to the United States Constitution, it demonstrates that the framers' main objective in drafting the Seventh Amendment was to preserve the limitation on the ability of the appellate court, specifically the Supreme Court, to review de novo and overturn a civil jury's findings of fact. It always preserved the trial court's common law duties and authority to regulate the submission of issues to the jury. Under the common law, the trial judges are accorded great discretion in controlling verdicts. The trial court is vested under the common law with the right to control the order of the trial and the submission of the issues to the jury. What the Seventh Amendment did not do or purport to do was limit in any respect this broad authority that was vested in the trial court. That's why trial court jury devices such as new trials, remitter, JNOV, directed verdicts were deemed constitutional. Likewise, the authority to bifurcate, which is premised on the common law right of the trial judge to control the order and submission of issues, is likewise constitutional. Actually, the ordering of separate trials of liability and damages was commonplace in the 17th century law of account render. There was no common law requirement that these trials be held before the same jury. Early federal cases settled issues for trial for separate juries, actions that were both at law and an inequity. So at the time the Wisconsin Constitution was adopted, there certainly was no historical common law right to have one jury consider all the issues of the case at one time. At the same time that bifurcation was allowed at common law, the common law also required the jury's verdict be unanimous. There's no showing historically that the requirement of a unanimous verdict in any way limited the trial judge's common law discretion to bifurcate issues for trial before separate juries. In fact, when this court decided that the court could remand only part of the trial, the court did so recognizing the inherent authority of the court to regulate the submission of issues. So it's all one in the same. Now, there's been much talk in the briefs, I didn't really hear it this morning, on the 5-6th Amendment to the Wisconsin Constitution in 1922. And all that did was take out of the Constitution the common law requirement of always having unanimous verdict. There's no showing of any intent by changing the common law rule on a unanimous verdict to change the common law rule with regard to the trial court's control over the submission of the issues to the jury. So the 5-6th Amendment does not in any respect preclude bifurcation. In addition, both this court and the United States Supreme Court have recognized that the right to a jury trial does not unalterably preserve the English law of the 1700s or inhibit the introduction of procedural reform. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have sanctioned the appellate practice of reversing in part a jury verdict and remanding for a new trial on limited issues. As the United States...
Let me just stop you for a minute. As I understand this, although we've got several authors that write about bifurcated trial in the common law, it's hard to find concrete, hard cases that indicate.
That's correct. Okay.
So on the history issue, I would call it a draw at the moment.
I would not, Your Honor.
I understand. But on the history issue, you still have a hard time finding absolute concrete evidence. You do have a lot of people who have written who say that it was there, but okay. Then let's get to whether it's constitutional or not. You still have a power issue. So assuming it's constitutional to bifurcate, you have a power issue. And we've talked about the inherent power of the trial court or this court. And court has inherent power, I think, to regulate the trial and make rules and as to how it's going to hear evidence and how it's going to handle a jury. And as Justice Sykes said, as long as there's no bar to it doing it. So it has inherent power up only until a particular issue. And it's that particular bar is to change, at least in this state as I understand it, you can't change the court. No court can change a substantive right of a litigant. By rule, we're not authorized to do that under 751.12. It's a separation of power issue. So the question might be whether or not the trial court has the inherent power to determine how the jury will decide these issues or claims, barring express legislative authority.
Right.
Where do you find the express legislative authority?
The expense legislative, well, first of all, Your Honor, going back, it is my position that the court has the inherent authority under the common law.
To do what?
To bifurcate issues to be heard before separate juries. Okay.
Then that assumes it's constitutional.
That assumes it's constitutional, and that is part of, from my historical research, that is part of the inherent power of the court, that it was recognized at common law, and that it is constitutional. Going to the next issue, is there anything in the statutes that would in any way prohibit that?
So you don't have a statute that authorizes.
Well, according to when this issue was dealt with 9 years ago by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in Zawatowski, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals looked at 906.1 sub 1 and determined that indeed preserved the inherent authority of the court, because it talks about that the judge will exercise reasonable control over the mode and order of interrogating witnesses. At the same time, the Court of Appeals looked at 805.05 sub 2 and said, well, while it did not authorize bifurcating individual issues for trial, neither did it prohibit the trial court from taking such action. Now, this occurred 9 years ago in a published decision by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. This court denied review. Now, my understanding is when the Court of Appeals issued that opinion, there has been no action since by the legislature or anyone else saying that no, that isn't correct, that it isn't authorized by the rules, and by the silence, that is acquiescence in the Court of Appeals decision 9 years ago that indeed it is authorized by the Wisconsin statutes.
Was that two separate juries or one jury?
My understanding by the transcript that's been submitted to this court by Mr. Thrasher that it was to be two separate juries.
Really? Well, where did I read that it was just one jury trying two different issues separately?
I don't...
I think because
I thought it was in her brief.
Okay. They never had to get to the second jury.
Right.
The first one said that the statement that was in question was never uttered. There's defamation.
Right. But my understanding was at the time of bifurcation, the idea was that in all probability it would go to two separate juries. But my understanding is it did not, in fact, do that. So,
counsel, on that, I won't call that Kissinger cases. I won't call Zawatowski, is that what I won't call that incorrect. Petition for review was denied. But let me call it odd. And why I think it's odd is that a court would use a rule of evidence as the basis for making a decision on the rule of trial court procedure. That rule of evidence deals with how witnesses are going to be examined and not the practice and regulation of the procedure in the trial court. I mean, I just find that, as I read that case, just as you say, the court said that they looked to the statute, and there's nothing that does not authorize it.
Right.
And then they looked to the rules of evidence
right.
to control the rules of trial practice and procedure. Seems odd to me.
It may be odd, but I think that it's clear, and it's been, you know, the law of the state of Wisconsin for 9 years, that it is authorized by statute, and that there's nothing in the statutes that prohibits it. So that's where we sit. We sit with inherent authority of the court, I believe, under the common law. We sit with no statutory prohibition. And as the Wisconsin Court of Appeals read it, there is authorization, albeit under the rules of evidence. And so when you look at it as a whole, is there any prohibition here for what the trial court did? And the answer is no. So what we get down to is essentially, did the trial judge abuse its discretion in bifurcating the liability and damages?
Ms. Hunt, if I can ask, you've said several times there's no prohibition against doing this. I'm just looking at 805.092, which has been mentioned several times. How do you get around the language that if more than one question must be answered to arrive at a verdict on the same claim, the same 5/6 of the jurors must agree on all the questions? What does that mean?
Well, it's the same thing that it exists on a remand, because you don't, the court has never read that to require that you always have all the issues submitted.
A remand is a very different situation than a situation in the first instance where a judge is saying we're going to have two separate juries. One is going to try liability and one is going to try damages. Remand is not the same situation.
I disagree, Your Honor, because I think it's only a procedural difference. A procedural difference that doesn't make any difference when you're looking at the statutes, because if you're reading the statute that it has to be 5/6 submitting the claim, then you would also be precluding a remand with a limited remand on limited issues. So I don't see a difference, and that's what the federal courts have looked at. They can't see a difference procedurally between ordering bifurcation in the first instance and after remand.
Well, what do you think the language, the same 5/6 of the jurors, means in that statute?
The same 5/6 of the jurors means as to those issues that are submitted to the jury. That it doesn't mean that you have to have the whole case submitted at one time, but as to the issues that are submitted to the jury, in that verdict form, they must be 5/6. So you can have partial, in essence, partial verdicts, which is really what you have on a remand situation. You don't have the 5/6, the same 5/6 jurors deciding all the issues in the case. So,
counsel, what you just did is you replaced the term that's in the statute, which is claim, with your word issues. And let me take a look, and I'm following up, if I may, Justice Quixon, exactly what you're asking. Here you have the words of the statute. If more than one question may be answered to arrive at a verdict on the same claim. Now, I interpret that to mean, for instance, in a negligence case, the claim of negligence. Liability is an issue. Damages is an issue. But the claim is a claim, a cause of action claim in negligence. And
Then, Your Honor, you couldn't have the limited remand either.
Well, don't you have different issues on remand? One, you may be in waiver and consent because there was no objection to a remand on the jury issue. People can stipulate.
You can, sure, but you can also have where the party who the issue is being remanded objects. I mean, so you have the same thing as you have here in a bifurcation.
What may have happened, though, is that no one has ever on remand said, no, I want the whole thing tried because I'm entitled to that as with a single jury. So that what you may have had in all these cases, this issue hasn't arrived.
Well, I think that issue arrived early on in the history of the courts, where there was the issue whether you could just, you know, demand a remand of the whole case versus that the court could not remand partial issues. And that's what the court dealt with, you know, a long time ago, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with in 1931, because that issue was open to constitutional debate. And the court said no, that the constitutional right to a trial by jury isn't static, and although they found no basis that the appellate court could remand only part, they found that it was not unconstitutional. So, I mean, that debate has gone on, so that's probably why you don't see it anymore. You know, so there isn't any issue. But that what has happened is that the like I said, the federal courts, the commentators across the board have been unable to see the distinction between a remand of partial issues and the bifurcation in the first instance.
I think that that's a decent argument, a darn good argument. In the grand sense. But here we have statutes.
Right.
And of course, our statute and the way we approach it is different than the federal folks approach it. And 80509, in my opinion, deals with jury trials. In fact, it's headed trials. And then this specifically deals with the verdict during a jury trial. I mean, when we get to issues of appellate procedure and courts remanding, we deal with different rules for appellate practice. This is jury trial practice, the content a verdict.
But you would still be under that rule on a remand. I don't see the distinction, if that's how it's being read, that if you're reading it, that you can never separate out to separate verdicts. A negligence, you cannot separate out liability from damages because they're all part of the negligence claim. I do not see how that changes on remand because you're still under the same statutes for the trial procedure. So it seems to me they go hand in hand. Either you're eliminating the remand or, you're eliminating the bifurcation in the first instance.
Saying that because of the statute, if you followed the interpretation that I'm advancing in my question, that then any remand by the court as to an issue would be against the law, it would contravene the statute.
Right, exactly. So I think you'd have the same, you'd have that problem, and this court has never viewed the statute that way to eliminate the remands, and I do not see anything that would disallow the court bifurcating the issues for separate verdicts before separate juries in the first instance. When we go on to the, it's constitutional and it is in accord with the Wisconsin statutes, then we just get down to the issue of abuse of discretion. And there was no abuse of the discretion of the trial judge here. The potential for the jury to become confused, the prejudice to the parties, and the convenience, economy, or delay that resulted from the bifurcation. So looking at the record that was presented to the trial court, he certainly did not abuse his discretion in ordering the bifurcation. Moving on briefly to the issue of recreational immunity. The trial court here concluded that the Pertzborns and State Farms would be entitled to recreational immunity, but for what it concluded was the existence of a material issue of fact as to whether the social guest exception 895.526 sub D applied. It's Pertzborn's position that there is no material issue of fact and the recreational immunity standard gives the Pertzborns immunity. Now, it's clear that the trial court, reading the grant of immunity in the first instance, concluded that the Pertzborns would be entitled to immunity but for the question of the exception. And it is our position before this court that clearly reading the statute as written and reading it in accord with the liberal construction that this court must place on it, that it is clear that recreational immunity would apply. Now going to the exception, first we look at the fact that sledding is expressly included as a recreational activity under the statute, and CW was engaged in that recreational activity at the time of the injury. To be a social guest, the guest must be expressly and individually invited by the private property owner for the specific occasion during which the death or injury occurs. Now, irrespective of any prior invitation extended to the Waters by the Pertzborn's daughter, Kathleen, it was never disputed that Waters was not expressly and individually invited to remain on the property after Kathleen was called in to dinner. So given these undisputed facts, Waters...
What if we didn't have that fact? What if this occurred
before dinner, then would this be a social guest?
Your Honor, our position would be no, that it would not be a social guest before dinner, given the fact that the Prudsborns did not, never gave permission to the daughter and CW to sled down the hill. The problem, Your Honor, is that there is a fact issue there with regard to between what CW says and what Mrs. Prudsborn says. So for purposes of the appeal, I'm concentrating on what happened at the time that Kathleen was called into dinner, because there really is no material issue of fact with regard to that. With regard to, it's interesting if you look at the Waters brief, because they concede actually that the social guest exception does not apply, because the injury did not occur on the Prudsborns' property. Lynette raises the interesting question as to whether the grant of immunity, which on its face does not require that the death or injury actually occur on the owner's property, must be read to be limited to death or injury that occurs on the owner's property, because some of the exceptions to the immunity so state. But since the recreational immunity statute is liberally construed so as to afford property owners great protection, the fact that the immunity and the exceptions do not always match is really, you know, irrelevant, in the sense that what you are doing is looking at this statute and construing it as written, and broadly construing it to protect the property owner.
But counsel, usually when we're dealing with these recreational statutes and the question of guests and exceptions arise, other exceptions, we are dealing with people who are, if not unknown to the property owner, at least at fairly arm's length from the property owner. Linville, you know, there was no connection between the property owner and the person that was there taking a look at fishing, etc. But here, this is not what I consider an arm's length person. Chris Waters is not arm's length. He's a friend of the 11-year-old, led there before. His mother was aware that he was there. Clearly, Chris Waters was a total stranger. I shouldn't say clearly, but Chris Waters was a total stranger. I would imagine Mom would have said, "Hey, what are you doing on my property? Get off." Plus, she was aware that he was there sledding. How do you answer that? Because all those facts seem to point to social guests.
First of all, it's true that this court has not been faced with that, but I know that the Court of Appeals has been faced with situations where, you know, it's neighborhood children, children that are known. And I see that that really has no application or is irrelevant to the construction of the recreational immunity statute, except as it applies to the language of the statute, which says that the guests must be expressly and individually invited by the private property owner for the specific occasion during which the death or injury occurs. So the legislature made it very clear that the fact that, you know, you might have had, they may have gone sledding in the past, the neighborhood children, that that is not what the social guest exception is meant to apply to, because it talks about the specific occasion during which the death or injury occurs. So that is the focus here, is the fact that you have the situation where you have Kathleen called into dinner. There's no facts that there was any intent or expectation that CW would remain on the property, that he would go sledding or anything else. So when you look at the statute applying to the facts, can you say that CW was expressly and individually invited by Kathleen or the Prudsborns for the specific occasion during which the death or injury occurs? And it is our position that there is no material issue of fact in that regard, and therefore we're entitled to recreational immunity.
Are you contesting that Kathleen, as an occupier of the property, had at least the authority to invite and create a social guest situation?
Well, that's a problem, because Kathleen actually has just been brought into the case. My understanding is after this appeal was filed. And they're claiming that she has the status under the statute as an owner. It is our position that an 11-year-old would not have the authority or the ability to grant that invitation, so the answer would be no. But, I mean, we do have the situation where she's now just been brought into the case, which, you know, wasn't a factor when this case was initially presented on appeal.
I assume if you say an 11-year-old would have that authority, then a 17 and a 9/10-year-old wouldn't have that authority either. And my palms are sweating because I have teenagers. I just want to know if I'm going to be liable to my friends. You
know? I guess I would go that no, that the 17-year-old and 9/10 does not have authority either.
Well, but, you know, I mean,
but
happens all the time.
Right.
That the 17-year-olds are inviting friends over. You're saying by that, the very status of their minority under the law, they don't have an authority to invite social guests over for specific purposes?
Well, it's interesting because when this court dealt with the social guests before the enactment of the exception, you had the situation where the court looked to the fact that, if I remember right, they were swimming on the property with the parents' permission. So even though you had, I think at that, it was a 16 or 17-year-old involved, the court looked at the fact there that you had, it was authorized by the parents. So, I mean, at least before the exception was, that factored into the court's decision, it appears to be. So it would seem to me that when you're applying the exception, and again you're giving a liberal interpretation to protect the property owner, it would seem to me that that a minor such as the 11-year-old here would not have such authority and could not be the one who is expressly inviting the minor. So based on the record presented to the court, respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the bifurcation, but that the court reverse the trial court's determination that there was a material issue of fact with regard to the application of recreational immunity, in order that as a matter of law, recreational immunity applies, in order the Pritz, Barnes, and State Farm dismissed from this case.
If we decide for you on recreational immunity, doesn't that end the case? We don't even have to address the bifurcation, do we?
There is another defendant.
Oh, who's that?
That's the driver, the house, and MSI, and so there would still be that issue with regard to them for bifurcation. But it's true, we'd be gone. Thank you.
You still have a couple minutes left. The statute defines owner as a person who owns, leases, or occupies property. And because of, you know, owns and occupies in the same, they obviously are different people.
Right.
And it seems to me that at least a very strong argument can be made that Kathleen is an occupier.
And that's the argument that is being made now, that she is. The problem is, and I guess it gets down to a question of statutory interpretation. Can a minor be deemed to be an occupier under the statute? And it's our position that the answer would be no, that they would not be an occupier. Because she has an 11-year-old has no control over the property. I mean, it isn't akin to the owner, which I think an occupier could be a tenant. It could be, you know.
It boils down to, though, an invitation for, even if you're an occupier, whether you're inviting this social guest. So it's a consent issue, isn't it, rather than occupier?
It is. It's important, though, because of they're trying to put responsibility on the 11-year-old here now. So I guess in that sense, we are concerned about the owner-occupier. No further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Let me touch on a couple things that were raised. First, briefly on recreational immunity. I don't know where this requirement that he wasn't expressly re-invited came from. I don't know whether you have to every 10 minutes or 15 minutes say, gee, you're still welcome to stay here. The fact is, and the facts are well set out in the brief about the invitation over there, the fact the parents were aware, at least there's an issue of fact as to whether they were aware that he was there, and I don't need to run through all those facts. I think in my mind, and in the circuit court's mind, those facts presented an issue of fact as to whether this exception applies. If you read the brief and listen to the argument, though, the argument is essentially that the social guest exception only applies to accidents which occur on the property. This accident did not occur on the property, and therefore this exception does not apply. That argument is made, and again, that argument is one that leads to the situation where if somebody invites over young children and the one falls into the swimming pool on the property, there's no immunity, but if he runs out in the road and is hit, there is immunity. And that simply does not make any sense for that to be the interpretation that is afforded this statute. On the other issue, this isn't a Seventh Amendment case. The Seventh Amendment doesn't apply. Since Norville and Hansford, the Wisconsin system and the federal system have diverged on these issues long ago. It has to be decided by Wisconsin law in light of Wisconsin's constitution, Wisconsin's traditions. In terms of severance back long ago, if you look at most of those cases, in fact, I dare say all those cases, they have to do with actions at bar and actions in abatement, what we today would call affirmative defenses. And because affirmative defenses were not an element of plaintiff's claim, affirmative defenses could be severed and tried separately. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about trying liability and damages separately. On the issue of remands, and doesn't that run afoul of the Constitution and of Section 80509, again, there is a difference between a jury rendering a verdict and the court taking control of the verdict once it is rendered. And perhaps a better example is if you sent the case to the jury to try the entire case. And the jury reached a decision on negligence and reached a determination on causation and was hopelessly deadlocked on damages. Could the court take that and say, well, you've reached a determination as to negligence and causation, and I'm going to take that verdict, and it's going to be okay as to those two items, and I'm just going to go try damages before a separate jury. We're going to try that again. It couldn't do so. And the reason is because of this unanimity, or now 5-6 rule. They have to decide on all the elements that are in the case at the time it is sent to them, that they have to agree on those 5-6.
Counsel, does anything preclude the parties to agree to bifurcation?
I think that the parties could stipulate to bifurcation. I think that there is no problem with them doing that in appropriate circumstances, and I think if you look at some of the cases that have been cited, it appears that some of them at least are based on stipulation for the parties. The last thing is, why is it important? I mean, we spent a whole lot of time talking about the law and whether it's allowed or not allowed. And I think we give some reasons in the brief, but I think the benefit you get when you try the entire case together, and I think part of it comes from the law review article we cite, but part from theirs as well, one they cited, a Wisconsin law review article, is I think you tend to get more extreme results. If you face, the jury gets liability all or nothing, I think you're going to get more often findings for the defense. But that's because the normal process is in a case where you have liability is contested, damage is contested, and it goes to a jury, you may have people that go in there and they say, you know, I really don't think they're liable. And you have other people, well, I think they're really liable and they should pay a lot. And they sit around and they talk. And you've got 12 members from the community. You have a high percentage of them that have to agree. And in talking through all of the issues, compromises are made, minds are changed. And we're not talking about an illegal compromise verdict, but we're talking about viewing the case as a whole. Some of the people that may have been inclined initially to be against liability come on and say, well, I'm willing to find liability. Some of the damaged people come down. I'd be interested to see, on a bifurcated case, if you send just that second case to the jury just on damages, I suspect that part favors the plaintiffs, and that damages in those cases, when all they're hearing, you know the defendant's a bad guy, you know they're liable, all we're deciding on damages, I suspect you get more extreme verdicts, both from the findings of no liability and from higher damage awards, when you don't have the entire case being considered by 12 people and agreement by 10 of those on all elements of the claim. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Hunt. That concludes our hearing.